Okay, so the title of my talk is Observers as Primitives, but first I'll essentially talk about which notions we can take as the primitives of a theory when we want to construct it, and whether these notions are good candidates for that or not. So basically, when we think of a theory, when we want to build some kind of theory of the universe, then what we do usually is that we look at the theory and we try to quantitize it, but we can also pose an inverse problem and say that, okay, what if we meditate on, we look at the theory and we meditate on what it is actually a theory of. So for example, we take a theory of a quantum theory in Hilbert space and then think of what it is actually a theory of. So for that, we usually take some notions as like space, communication between agents, or quantum states, or agents themselves, or time, and so on and so on. And now we can look at these notions and see whether they're good primitives of the theory, which if we want to build a theory from scratch. So first, to give an example of what I actually mean by saying that we take something as a primitive of the theory, we can look at the following example. So in a work by Kao, I hope I pronounced this right, Space from Hilbert Space, Recovering Geometry from Bulk Entanglement, the authors use Hilbert space, the factorization of the Hilbert space and entanglement as primitives, and then they reconstruct the space-time structure using the following track. So first they take Hilbert space and decompose it into a large number of factors. And then they consider states which are redundancy constrained, so the entropy of the region obeys an area law. Then they use the mutual information between two factors to define a metric on a graph connecting these factors. Then they reconstruct smooth large flat geometries from such a metric. And then they get to the space-time structure for that. From that, however, there is already sort of a problem even in the first step of this construction. So in the first step we factorize the Hilbert space into a large number of factors, and the question is whether the factorization we use is unique or not. And it's also connected to the question whether in this case we can use entanglement as primitive or not. Because actually, for a given state, entanglement is not a property of a state itself, but a property of a state relative to the factorization of the Hilbert space. This can be easily seen on the following example. So suppose we have a four-dimensional Hilbert space, and we have two different factorizations of this Hilbert space. So first is A bar, second is B B bar, which are characterized by the following isomorphisms, phi A, which is the usual isomorphism we would use for a four-dimensional Hilbert space. Like we have the tensor product of two states I and j, and then we write it as ij. And then we have the Bell state, which in original Hilbert space could be written like this. For this factorization, it takes this form, it is an entangled state indeed. However, and it's maximally entangled, actually. However, if we take the isomorphism phi b, which can be described as following. So in this case, it maps the tensor product of I and j into psi ij, which is a Bell state. In that case, this Bell state can be written as simply as a product of two states, which makes it unentangled. Thus, this example shows that entanglement is not a property of a state itself, but a property of a state relative to the factorization. And so if we want to define entanglement properly, then we have to also take into account the factorization of the space used. This leads us to so-called factorization problem, which was formulated by Laura, who did the bachelor thesis in our group. Yeah, and this work should be soon published on Archive. So basically, I will formulate this this problem for two agents, but it can also easily be extended for an arbitrary number of agents. Let us suppose that we have agents A and B, who do not know their isometries phi A and phi B, and they have some kind of set of measurements they use and set of unitaries. And what they essentially need to do, they need to reconstruct or characterize in some way this mapping. So they can, in a sense, understand each other's factorizations, connect each other's factorizations. There are two scenarios of this problem. First one is device independent, when the agents do not possess any knowledge about their sets of measurements and unitaries. And device dependent, when agents have a local mathematical description of their sets of measurements and unitaries. To solve this problem, or to attempt to solve this problem, first we need to characterize which types of relationships two systems A and B can have. So there are essentially five cases that we can look at. So the first case is when two systems A and B are disjoint. Second case is when A is nested into system B. The third case is when they overlap. The fourth case is when these two systems are similar. And these four first cases can also be united as a case when we say that two agents are in a sense compatible. And the fifth case is exactly the case we looked at the example, and it is the case when two agents are incompatible. So this picture-like description gives an intuition of how this relationship between two systems is constructed, but this can also be formally written in algebraic sense, which I omitted here. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between the fourth and fifth case?
Fourth and fifth? You mean when they're similar and this when they overlap and so basically so so you mean this case and this case?
Yes.
So intuitively you can think of it as for example so imagine A has its her space as spanned by in her in the outer description as 0 and 1, and here B has its space spanned by 1 and 2, and then they in a sense overlap on this state they have. But here is exactly the case when the overlapping of the mappings is not as direct. So it's the thing that we looked at in the example. So
is that a basis dependent statement?
So this division between this compatible and incompatible cases can be written in algebraic form. Like if you come to me after the lecture, I can show you. So basically the whole set of cases can be also described in this picture. So here we have the incompatible cases, then we have compatible cases. So here we have the disjoint case, overlapping, nested, and similar. And as it was shown by Laura in her work, the problem, the factorization problem, can be easily solved for this colored cases or device dependent scenario. In all other scenarios, this problem is essentially unsolved, and it remains to be discovered how it can be solved. And this factorization problem is shows to be very important, as the factorization of the space is not unique, and it also connects on how we understand the division of our system into subsystems. So, and it also kind of gives us a hint that maybe the notion of a system or a notion of factorization is not a very good primitive for the theory if it results in problems like this. So the second thing we can look at as a primitive of the theory is communication between agents. And I would just give you an intuitive why communication can be used as a primitive. So imagine we have two systems, A and B, and they are only allowed to send and receive signals. And what they want to know is how they're spatially related. So we can imagine four different scenarios. So we have systems A and B, and B is moving away, B is moving towards, B is rotating around A, and A is rotating around B. So let's say that agents send each other signals, or systems say send each other signals every second. So then for the first case, the time distance between two signals is bigger than 1 second, obviously. For the second case, less than 1 second. For the third case, for A, it's less than 1 second. For B, it's more than 1 second. And here it's reverse. And imagine now A is trying to understand in which kind of situation she is. And then she has no way of distinguishing between the first and the fourth situation if she gets a time interval more than 1 second. And she has no way of distinguishing between second and the third situation if she has a time interval less than 1 second between the signals. However, if we also propose that agents can communicate in a sense that they agree that every time they get a signal, they also send one by themselves immediately, then in this case, there is also the time distance, time interval between these two signals they send to communicate. So then in the first case, it's more than 1 second. In the second case, it's less than 1 second. And in the third and fourth case, it's exactly 1 second for both agents. So given this additional signal that they send to communicate, they can easily distinguish in which kind of situation they are in. So this example gives us an intuitive why communication between agents can be, in principle, used to reconstruct the structure of space. But this is still a work in progress, and hopefully some work can be done in this direction. So in all examples of primitives we looked at up until now, we all kind of use the notions of subjective, objective, and they all encompass agents in their essence. So that leads us to a conclusion that it might be reasonable to look at the agents as a primitive and to use the agents as a primitive of the theory. So if the agents are a primitive of the theory, so let us now consider agents of quantum systems. And when they start reasoning about each other's knowledge, we also need to come up with some kind of logical system that they should use. To look at this, the logical system, and to test logical systems that they can use, we can look at this famous thought experiment. I hope that everybody here heard about it. Yes? No? Okay. And but I will recap it a bit later. And we will test a classical logical system against this experiment. So the classical logical system that we will use for agents is the model logic. And we use it because it is a logical system that models the situations when agents have to reason about each other's knowledge. And this is exactly the situation that arises in the given thought experiment. So the important part of the model logic is the Kripke structure. And the Kripke structure is constructed out of a set of propositions phi, which contains all the propositions that can be made in the setting. Then a non-empty set of possible worlds, sigma. We'll come back to what possible worlds are a bit later. And a truth interpretation, pi, which depends on... It shows us the truth value of a given sentence phi based on the possible world it is proposed in, and the statement itself. And finally, a binary equivalence relation ki on a set of possible worlds. So two possible worlds belong to a binary relation ki of an agent I. If agent I considers world T possible given his information in world S. So this can be understood on a simple example. So now I am in Waterloo, and suppose I have no information about the outer world whatsoever, and I don't know what is the weather in Zurich. And for me, both scenarios, when it is raining in Zurich and it doesn't rain in Zurich right now, are equally possible. So both the worlds where it rains in Zurich and where it doesn't rain in Zurich belong to my equivalence relation. And finally, we use this notation, which means that agent I knows proposition phi in a world S of Kripke structure M, which is equivalence. So for each world in my equivalence relation, it holds that this proposition is true. Also, the important part of this model logic structure is the axioms of knowledge that we use to combine the statements. So there are four axioms of knowledge, namely the distribution axiom, the knowledge generalization rule, the truth axiom, and the positive and negative introspection axioms. Let's look at them a bit closer. So the first axiom is a distribution axiom, and it basically allows agents to combine their statements. So if they have the statement phi and the statement that psi follows from phi, then they can reach a conclusion that they know statement psi. And if you're familiar with the assumptions in the thought experiment, it also can be seen as generalizing assumption C in the original article. The second one is the knowledge generalization rule, and it basically says that if a fact is true, then in a world S, then all agents in this world know about this fact, and it's quite a strong assumption, and it can be also seen as an indication of what is the common knowledge of agents in a certain setup, and it covers the assumptions Q and U of the original heart. Then the third one is a truth axiom, and it basically says that if an agent knows the fact, then it is true, and it can be compared to assumption C as well. Then we have at last positive and negative introspection axioms, which say that the agents have the ability to introspect on their own knowledge. So if agent says that I know phi, then he can also say that I know phi. And it in a sense follows the assumption S of the original order. Then to briefly recap the thought experiment, if somebody forgot about it, then so basically we have agents A and B were in their labs, and agents Urso and Wegner on the outside, and agent A also has a system R in their lab, which is initially in this state, and then A measures this system R and recalls the result to her memory. So we get this state. Then, based on her outcome, she prepares the system S either in this state or this state. And then she sends the system to Bob's lab, where Bob measures it and recalls the result to his memory as well. So we end up with this state. So we can rewrite this final state in two convenient ways, which incorporate the basis that Urso and Wegner use while measuring A's and B's labs respectively. So they measure them in OK-fail basis, and then they communicate about their result, and then if they both get OK, the experiment holds. So if we write this state in the following way, then the agents can make the following conclusions. So Urzoa can say that if she got OK, then she can say with certainty that B got outcome 1. And Bob can say if I got outcome 1, then Alice got outcome 1 as well. And if we rewrite the state like this, it becomes clear that Alice can argue that if she got outcome 1, then Wegner got outcome fail. Also, the probability, we can see that the probability of Urso and Wegner both getting outcomes OK is non-zero. Thus, it means that it will happen at some point. And then if we combine all the statements that we previously considered, we get a contradiction. So we start with Wegner and Urso both getting OK, which B equals 1 follows, then A equals 1 follows, and then Wegner got fail, which is an obvious contradiction. So if we apply the model epistemic model logic to the reasoning that agents use in this experiment, we can do it in the following fashion. So first we have that agent A knows that V fail for follows from A equal 1. Then we use the truth axiom. Then we can use the distribution axiom, and then we can process all the other statements, and then we come to this conclusion. Thus, when we consider that the agents in their reasoning use the epistemic model logic, which is a classical logic that classical agents would use to reason about their outcomes, we get a contradiction. That's when we can make a conclusion that we do not have a sound logic system to analyze agents' reasoning when quantum measurements are involved. So what we can do is we can try and make suggestions for generalizing the axioms of model logic that we use. First suggestion was to modify the truth axiom and make it a trust axiom and say that there is a certain trust structure in the experiment a priori. And we say that an agent I trusts an agent J and denote it like this, if and only if we can remove the according knowledge operator. What are the advantages of such a structure? First, it shows explicitly that trust is not transitive. So, for example, if Urzoa trusts Bob in our experiment and Bob trusts Alice, it doesn't necessarily mean that Urzoa trusts Alice. So Ursula can even not think about Alice as an actual agent that gets a certain outcome. She can just think of an Alice as a quantum system in a lab and not consider Alice an agent. And the second advantage is that it can be used for describing persistence of agents' memories over time, because the other thing we can do for this thought experiment is that we can explicitly label different agents in time as different agents, as different agents. So basically, if we have agent A at time T0, we have agent A at time T1. It is also not trivial and not necessary that agent A at time T0 trusts agent A at time T1. However, the disadvantage of this system is that if we have the following trust structure in our thought experiment, it can be proven that if we replace the truth axiom with the trust axiom, we still obtain a contradiction. The proof of that can be seen in our paper. The second way to generalize the axioms would be to introduce context. So the motivation for introducing context lies in so-called two-dimensional semantics. So this is the extension for semantics of model logic, which considers the cases when the truth value of a statement depends not only on the world it is produced in, but also on some other factors, for example, time or who produced the statement and so on. And then we define a context space as the following vector, where A, B, and so on are the elements of the set of the agents, and E1, E2, and so on are local or global and describe whether the proposition agent makes is meant locally or globally. So the examples would be this one. So this means that agent T2, agent A at time T2 locally knows that A equals 1. Or this one is agent A at time T2 knows that globally the state of her lab is the following. And finally, this one would mean that agent B at time T3 locally knows that agent A at time T2 locally knows that A equals 1. So this, the introduction of the context space also motivates us to update the definition of trust. So now we should keep track of the context when we introduce trust. And so then we say that if C trusts B, then what we do is that when we remove the corresponding knowledge operator, we add it to the context, to the context vector. And if we use this context space, and if we also assume the rigid constraint that two statements can be united in the distribution axiom only if their contexts align, so they coincide completely, then the contradiction in the thought experiment is not reached, cannot be reached, because even in the first step of the proof, when we combine two statements, because they're made by different agents, their contexts do not align. And thus, it makes it impossible to unite them in a one statement. But however, this constraint, as I said, is quite rigid, and it is not clear whether we can or we cannot unite the propositions, combine the propositions in other cases. These are the ways that we can try to generalize the axioms. So now we come to the conclusions. So looking at all the examples that we made, we can say that every every primitive that we took somehow encompassed the notion of an agent. And so, as I said, maybe it's a good idea to take agents as the primitives and then see how far we would get in constructing a certain theory of physics. And also, to resolve the problem with the agents that we have is we can go and try to model agents as physical systems to understand the limitations of things like common logic systems and so on. Yeah, thank you.
Time for questions, and I believe after the question section, the organizers have something to say. So, ask away.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I looked on the latest version of this example, mm-hmm. but at least previous version, it's kind of a variation of Wigner friend,
yeah.
And you don't need, at least I couldn't see that there is any need for any special logic for anything. Of course, when somebody measured, performed quantum experiment, and he believes that he knows the outcome. And there is a Wigner friend who is able to make a measurement on him. Or sometimes he makes another measurement, so he messes his memory. He changes, he believes he knows the outcome, but both outcomes exist, so there is this problem with language. I know the outcome, but both outcomes exist, so then people say it's not. So I never saw any reason for introduce any kind of. Of course, you make somebody and you make measurement on him, then you should. Was no problem whatsoever in any interpretation. I couldn't see any.
Yeah, but so the thought experiment, we explicitly. So in the original description, it is explicitly said that certain agents make certain statements about their outcomes. And then they combine these statements in a certain way, and like logic also in a sense governs the way they combine these statements. And like in our article, we also show that this, as I have this logic, the classical model logic, align quite nicely with the assumptions that are made in the experiment, so they can be actually compared to this assumption. The thing is that we can also re-derive this contradiction considering agents which use classical model logic, and so they reason about their outcomes in some way, and we still get a contradiction, which means that maybe there is a problem with their reasoning or their how they combine their reasoning.
Just maybe then, if
yeah.
Can you show? Can you kind of explain the contradiction? Of course, if I'm a cat and I'm kind of dead and alive, and of course the alive cat says I'm alive, and but then somebody knows that he's in a superposition, so it looks like. But
yeah.
Well, where is the contradiction? And you believe that there is no setup? You cannot. You again repeated contradiction. Is there is, can you kind of say, show, where is the contradiction?
No, actually, I would probably, that's not quite, that won't be a quite a direct answer to your question, but actually the context, the space thing can nicely encompass this many words description, because so basically if I get if Alice gets outcome one in her lab, then she can say that, okay, luckily, I got the outcome one, but actually, as she might be a believer in many worlds, then actually, because I'm a believer of many worlds, I globally think that it's that I am in a superposition, right? So this, in that sense, context, the space gives us this advantage in the many world scenario. But as I said, like in the context space case, if we have this rigid constraint of combining statements only when their context coincides, then yes, the contradiction is not reached, but it's not, it might not be the case that we can only combine the statements only when the contexts are completely the same.
So many words have no problem. Bauman also have no problem with this, or Bauman do have problems?
Well, I think they do have problems.
What?
I think they do have problems.
I have a question, because this is obviously related to sort of epistemic interpretations, mm-hmm. and sort of perspectives,
yes.
and various things. Does this thought experiment have any implications for some of the epistemic approaches, like, say, ironic many worlds, for example, where you, you treat everything as a state of knowledge? Is there any problem there? Maybe you don't know, but maybe that can also help comment.
Yeah.
It seems closely related to reformulation.
You asked me a question instead of the speaker.
No. I can also rephrase it, is this a better formulation of, or better formalism to express epistemic type interpretations with?
I don't think I can answer this question, because it's like, here we use the epistemic model logic in the sense that we use it to model what agents say about their states, but not even states, about their outcomes. But otherwise, I'm not sure. I think it still has to be looked at.
When you talked about the non-unique factorization,
yes.
I didn't follow the relation between that part of your talk with the...
Ah, okay. So basically, I was just describing different... given examples of notions that we can possibly use as a primitives, that actually people use as a primitives. But for example, they use the division of space into subsystems as a primitive, but it has a certain problem that it's not unique. And that poses a question whether, and so basically the fact that it's non-unique. It says that different agents can have different perspectives on how the space is divided into subsystems. And it makes a point that maybe the division into subsystems is not as great primitive as we think. And the second is that we again have the notion of agent, which is implicitly in our theory.